You're listening to 5 Questions for a General, a production of the Modern War Institute at West Point. I am Dr. Charles Faint, the team lead for this podcast series, which features interviews of senior military leaders conducted by specially selected and trained West Point cadet hosts. These exchanges produce timely, relevant, and inspirational insights for professional development of leaders at all levels.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the 5 Questions for a General podcast. I'm Cadet Nathan Unks, your host, and it is my pleasure to be here today with retired Admiral Harry Harris, the former commander of U.S. Pacific Command and former U.S. Ambassador to South Korea. Admiral, welcome to the show.
Yeah, it's great to be here, even though it is West Point.
Well, sir, I guess that goes straight back into our first question then. So you are the first Admiral, actually, we've ever had on the 5 Questions for a General podcast, or maybe now for this episode, 5 Questions for an Admiral. Can you please take a few minutes to describe your origin story, specifically what attracted you to the Navy and why you decided to attend the Naval Academy rather than obviously the better academy here at West Point?
Yeah, so let me begin by thanking West Point for inviting this Navy guy today. It shows either real courage or a shortage of Army speak. To get to your origin question, yeah, so I grew up in the South. I was born in Japan, grew up in Tennessee. And then moved to Florida with my parents when I was going to junior high school. Mm. When I was in high school, I elected Navy Junior ROTC, one of the JROTC programs across the country. And from all the services, the high school I went to had the Navy. And so that opened up all the doors for me about opportunities post-high school. My parents didn't have any money, and so my dad told me that if I wanted to go to college, I'd have to earn it myself or join the military and try to get a GI Bill kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But I found out during ROTC that there was this thing called the Naval Academy, as well as the other service academies, and ROTC, and that the Navy would pay my way through college. And then not only that, if you went to the service academy, they'd pay you. So that was pretty appealing to me.
Perfect combination of the two.
Yeah. So that's how I ended up joining or applying for the Naval Academy. I might have applied for other service academies as well, but I was accepted. I got a nomination and then an appointment, and the normal process. Mm. And it was the best thing. I never looked back.
Awesome. I was wondering if you were born in Japan, you said, and then you grew up in the South in Tennessee and Florida. Did you have any military relation beforehand, or?
Yeah, my dad was a World War II and Korean War.
Oh, so awesome.
And my mother's Japanese, so she survived the war in Japan. And then they met during the occupation of Japan when my dad was stationed at Yokosuka Naval Base, and my mom was there trying to work. Mm. And so they met then, and then they got married, and I came along, and then he retired from the Navy. After 20 years as a Navy Chief Petty Officer, E-7, and then we went to his home state. He went back to his home state, which is Tennessee, and we lived there just on the western edge of Appalachia for 10 years. Mm-hmm. I went through elementary school there, grew up there, and then we moved to Florida.
That's a fantastic story. Thank you for sharing that. For our second question, during your tenure as commander of U.S. Pacific Command, the strategic environment in the Indo-Pacific underwent significant shifts. What do you see as the most pressing security challenges facing the region today, and how should the United States and its allies shift to meet them now?
Yeah, so I think the biggest shift during that time that you talk about is the rise of China. Mm. And China, to me, remains the biggest impediment to the notion of truly global security. So in that time frame and into now, you have the biggest threats that we face globally, are China, Russia, North Korea, and a growing and concerning alignment between those three countries and Iran. And so that's sort of the environment that you all find yourselves in today. And I would say that across my 40 years in the Navy and my time afterward in Korea, this is the most dangerous time that I've seen in my experience. So we truly live in dangerous times. These days, in my opinion.
And sir, what about specifically China and the Indo-Pacific? Do you find as a shift from say, when you were working with the Indo-Pacific Command?
Well, I think the shift is not a dramatic shift over the time, but a dramatic shift if you look at this time and 20 years ago, 30 years ago. You know, I think we got it wrong as a nation at the end of the 20th century, at the end of the Cold War, you know, 1990-ish timeframe, when we thought that China would morph into something like a global force for good and Russia would no longer threaten its neighbors or the West. Well, we got both of those wrong strategically at the end of the Cold War, and I think we're seeing the results of that strategic error now. And so you all at West Point, when you graduate, you're going to have to deal with that, just like the folks from the Naval Academy, Air Force Academy, ROTC, enlisted women and men. You know, you're going to have to deal with these threats that we face, that we have left for you, unfortunately, and I wish you the best at it.
Well, thank you very much, sir. If you were to point something out, I know, would it be, say, our shipbuilding capabilities? Would it be our presence in the Indo-Pacific? Or what exactly should America focus on in these next coming years to improve the situation in that area?
Yeah. So there's a couple of different approaches to that question. One is at the national level. You mentioned shipbuilding. We have to improve our domestic industrial base to meet the challenges of the 21st century. And whether that's additive manufacturing, AI, you know, all of the things that are in the news these days. But we have to be able to rebuild, the arsenal of democracy, which won World War II. I think we have it in us to do that, but we have to be focused on that. We have to resource it correctly in order to build the industrial base necessary to meet the challenges of the 21st century. So that's on the industrial side. And we have to realize as a nation that allies and alliances matter, that diplomacy and diplomats matter. And I think we do. When I say that, I mean to underscore the necessity of alliances, allies, partners, friends, and diplomacy and diplomats. And we have something that no other adversary, especially those that I mentioned, have. And that's a network of alliances and partnerships. What does China have? They have North Korea. We have all of our allies in the Pacific. We have NATO. We have our network of partnerships like the Quad and the like. All of those together set us apart. And I think those are the things we ought to be focusing on.
Sir, and so you mentioned diplomacy. And one of the events in your career was when you served as ambassador to South Korea, actually the country where I was born. But how did your service in the military prepare you to represent the United States in front of South Korea and those foreign nations?
Yeah, so I had a number of jobs along the way that helped prepare me for that. But if you read Dana Priest's book that she wrote in the early 2000s about the American way of war, and she talks about the proconsuls and combatant commanders and that kind of stuff. My time as combatant commander in the Pacific prepared me, I think, well for the role of being an ambassador, because I had to meet with most of the leaders and most of the U.S. ambassadors in the region throughout my time as an Indo-PACOM commander from 2015 to 2018. Before that, I was a Pacific Fleet commander of the Navy component under PACOM, and I met with those leaders then as well. So to be able to see that from the Cap Verde seat, that is the Indo-PACOM headquarters in Hawaii, prepared me well for that. One of my earlier jobs, when I was a three-star, I was the assistant to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, ACJCS. And that's a job whose title doesn't reflect what the job is. And that job is the fellow that travels with the Secretary of State throughout the world, has the direct interface between the Secretary of State and the Secretary of Defense and the chairman. And in that job, I met with many of the leaders in the Pacific that I dealt with as a PACOM commander. So that job prepared me well to be the ambassador, and also just the Byzantine machinations of the State Department. I got a good familiarity with all of that when I was in that job. So that helped.
So joint relations with your other branches and the leaders within those branches, you think helped you a lot with?
Oh, absolutely. That and the interagency. Mm. You know, the interagency is the intelligence community, the State Department, Treasury, Commerce, FBI, all of that stuff I was exposed to as the ACJCS. And all of those entities were represented in one form or another on the Indo-PACOM staff. So, you know, those taken in toto, they prepared me well to be the ambassador, in my opinion.
Yes, sir. And with that joint experience, I know you graduated from the Naval Academy and you're now here visiting West Point. And many times throughout history, the Army team and the Navy team have rivaled and also cooperated on and off the gridiron. I think back to General MacArthur and Admiral Nimitz in the Pacific Campaign during World War II. What have you found most useful in building high-performance teams in combined, joint, and interagency organizations where these rivalries may go deeper than just football games?
Yeah, so we make a lot of the rivalry, but it's really a team of rivalry, if you will. You know, we love each other 364 days a year, and then here comes our name. But it's much more than that. But I believe that the key to success in joint warfare, and you know, which is to say how America fights wars these days, is know your teammates. And you got to understand your teammates, their institutional histories, their culture. If you do that, then you have a leg up on the challenges that you're certainly going to face as a joint team.
And sir, how did you work around learning those cultures and then learning those people and how they work, where they come from, things like that?
Yeah, so in my experience, I learned it the hard way. You know, at one time in my career as a one-star, I was sent down to Guantanamo to be the commander of the joint task force there. I had no idea about working with the Army, and that's a very Army-centric organization at the time. There were 1,500 guards there, and most of those were Army. The headquarters staff was provided by the National Guard, so a very Army-centric organization. So that was my deep exposure to joint warfare. I did not have the benefit of going to the war college. The Navy gave me an opportunity to go other places, and I took those opportunities. But one of the deficiencies in my career has been the lack of joint professional military education, JPME, whether it's Naval War College, Army War College, Air War College, or National Defense University. I didn't do any of those. And all of those would have helped before I went to Guantanamo to understand the challenges that were presented to the Joint Task Force. In Guantanamo, there was just every three-letter, four-letter, two-letter entity you can think of was represented there. And so to understand the institutional history and the institutional historical rivalries between those entities, some of those entities, would have been very helpful. So I went into Guantanamo with a lack of expertise at the user level and joint command, but I left there, I think, with a deep appreciation of joint warfare, and that helped me immensely when I became the PENCOM commander, you know, a dozen years later.
Going off of that, for just your service within the military and within Indo-Pacific and with the joint branches and all the other organizations that you worked with, after that long career of service, what continues to drive your involvement in national and international affairs? And what advice do you have for listeners seeking purpose through service in their own communities?
Yeah, so what I do now, just to more fully answer your question, is, you know, I have three bodies. I call it three buckets of work, really, that I do. One is, you know, I sit on boards, whether they're corporate boards or nonprofit pro bono boards. And that's one bucket. I give a lot of speeches. That's bucket number two. And then bucket number three, is senior mentoring or mentoring or senior fellowing, whatever you want to call it. And that includes what I'm doing here today with you, what I'm going to do later today with cadets. It includes work with the National Defense University's Capstone Program, where we take one-stars, brand new one-stars across the joint force and take them around the world to visit countries and that kind of thing. And so the reason I do those things, especially the bucket number three, is because of a sense of giving back. You know, everything I've gotten, I got through the Navy and all of that. So it's an opportunity to give back. It's also a way to stay engaged. And the stay engaged part encompasses all of the buckets. So there's that desire to give back. There's a desire to stay engaged in what's happening in the world, at least intellectually. And so that's why I do the things that.
And sir, when you were a cadet, did you find any opportunities maybe that were extended to you by the Naval Academy or maybe that you found on your own where you were able to get into those mentor type relationships and either mentor, say, those back at home or maybe, like you said, with the one-star general program that you're talking about where you're able to go and see other countries? And
You mean when I was a midshipman?
Yes, sir. A midshipman, yes, sir.
Actually, no. When I was a midshipman, it was all I could do to keep up with the program. You know, I did that poorly. So I didn't have time to do other things like what you're doing, actually, and what many of the cadets here that I see are doing, and what midshipmen that I see at Annapolis are doing. And I'm envious of them. I wish I was smart enough to have had time in my calendar to do that. But between struggling with academics, I was a varsity athlete and that kind of thing, I just did not have the bandwidth to do all the things that I wished in hindsight I could have done.
And sir, you mentioned your academics. When we were reading through your biography, we heard the term, a couple terms actually. One was the old goat and one was the gray owl. We have a term here called the goat, and I think it's a little bit different. Our goat is the lowest ranking cadet in their graduating class, and they get this thing called a goat fund where the cadets above them put in a dollar into a pot, and then the goat gets it at graduation. Yeah. But I don't believe you were the goat of your class, but you were the old goat and the gray owl. So if you take a second to kind of find what those were.
We have the same thing that you're talking about. We call it the anchor man, anchor midshipman owl. And it's, each member of the graduating class puts a dollar into a pot, and then the anchor graduate gets that money. So it's a good story. I imagine there's some jockeying for position at that last
spot. Yes, sir.
But that's kind of risky business.
It is.
All right, you might try too hard and end up, not graduating, I suppose. In my case, I did get through the academy, though I thought it was a big struggle at the time. But on to the specifics of your question, yeah, the old goat is the longest serving Naval Academy graduate still on active duty. So that's just a testament to time, longevity, and age, right? So I became the old goat, I think, in 2017 or so. I'd been in the Navy at that point 39 years. It's based on the day of graduation. And so, and class standing comes in a little bit if there are more than one graduate still on active duty. Mm-hmm. But I was amongst the last graduates on active duty at the academy in 2017 or so. However, in 2018, when I retired, I passed the old goat on to my classmate who took over Southern Command, Kurt Tidd, and he became the old goat. Then he passed on to another class. The gray owl is the same sort of thing, but it's the longest serving naval flight officer. Naval flight officer is the backseater, not the pilot, but the other fellow in the cockpit earlier of the airplane. It's the longest serving naval flight officer based on winging date. And that's, again, it's a testament to longevity, old age, and being alive. So I was the gray owl in 2015, and I kept that until I was there.
Sir, and while you were a naval aviator, you logged over your career over 4,400 flight hours, and you served in numerous major operations from Desert Storm to Odyssey Dawn. Looking back, which experiences influenced your philosophy on teamwork, risk, and decision-making under pressure the most?
Yeah, I think it goes back to maybe one of the earlier questions that you asked, but the lesson is that teams matter and people matter. So you have to understand the people who are on your team and try to get to know them and what drives them so that as a functioning team, you can do better. So that's the fundamental lesson, is that teams matter. Whether they're small teams or big teams, but teams matter, leadership matters, and that's what you're learning here at West Point and what I learned at the academy, at the Naval Academy, that leadership and leaders matter. And with regard to risks, everything we do shows up somewhere on the risk scale. So you have to understand the risks, but in order to understand the risks, you have to understand the rule sets, right? So if you're going to take a risk that involves bending or breaking a rule, you have to know those rules first so you know how far to take it. But everything we do, whether it's working in an office or working in a program or being on the front lines of combat, involves risk. And hopefully the things that you're learning here at West Point will help you to understand that so you can be an effective risk taker and an effective risk manager once you're out there with the forces.
Yes, sir. And as a naval aviator, I know I was wondering, with your also joint experience with working one with other branches and other nations as well, did you ever work as a naval aviator specifically with, say, other branches at, like the Air Force or maybe other countries, maybe the French Air Force or Navy or maybe Japanese?
I'm a maritime patrol aviator, so that's P-3 Orions. Now it's P-8 Poseidon aircraft, land-based, not carrier-based. So we were working on deployment all the time with host nations. In my time, the P3 was an ubiquitous airframe platform globally. And so the Japanese, the Koreans, the Australians, the New Zealanders flew that. The French didn't fly the P3, but they flew the Atlantique, the Brits flew the Nimrod, and all of that. So anti-submarine warfare was a global task during the Cold War.
Mm.
And so we worked with host nation militaries all the time. During Desert Shield, Desert Storm, we were doing surveillance, working with all of the countries that were doing a similar mission in support of ground forces in Kuwait and Iraq. And that followed on in OEF, Overland Afghanistan, using those sensors to look for ground targets, and in OIF in Iraq. Now, the Navy is flying the P-8 Poseidon, which also has become an ubiquitous airframe for the long-range surveillance and anti-submarine warfare mission sense.
And so you said those are not carrier-based. So did you ever have to spend that much time on a carrier or on a boat? I couldn't imagine personally.
Yeah, no, I did one tour on an aircraft carrier, but it was with a ship's cup. It wasn't in a flying role.
I think you got the best of both worlds.
I think so. But yeah, I went to naval carrier. So.
Well, best of both worlds always has at least one disadvantage, doesn't it? You alluded to your academics, and I wanted to ask you a question about your major and how you decided to pick what you ended up with and what your process was for that.
Yeah, so that's not a great story, but it's a long story. You know, we select our majors then during the second semester of our plebe period. It may have been the end of the first semester. At any rate, you know, they encourage you to select a technical major, and I selected marine engineering, which was really nuclear engineering.
Mm.
I don't know why I did that. I mean, you know, it's one of those things, but that did not go well for me. So in my youngster year, yearling year, I guess, sophomore year, I decided that I wanted to be a math major, which was probably really the dumbest thing I've ever done.
It might have been, would have been mine too as well.
I'm trying to go from something that's like applied math to like real math, right? I mean, theoretical Einstein stuff. So I failed in math, and I'll just say for your listeners that it is possible to get a zero on a test, because I got one on a test once, a zero out of 100. So recognizing that math was not my strong suit, at the beginning of my second class year, my junior year, I shifted into physics, which was like another dumb decision, and I quickly failed out of physics. And was allowed, thanks to the Naval Academy, they allowed me to shift once again, change my major again for the third time into general engineering. General engineering is the engineering major that folks who fail out of the hard engineering, you know, the electrical engineering, systems engineering, mechanical engineering, real engineering, if you will, they fail into general engineering. So that's what I did. I passed all my courses. I had enough credits to graduate, and I graduated on time. But it was a struggle throughout my youngster year, my sophomore year, and my second class year.
Sir, I think that shows some real resilience that a lot of us could learn from. Do you believe that resilience of having to go through all those different majors or come back from that many failures of your own, did that help you, I guess, either in your career or building your resilience in that way?
Sure. I got exposed to that sort of resilience issues early on. And that clearly helped me throughout.
After failing at something, how can you change your mindset to end up succeeding in another way? That I believe that's a lesson that everyone should be able to take away from as we all fail.
If I failed, then I would not have the opportunity to be an officer, not have the opportunity to graduate from Annapolis. In your case, West Point. And so that was a powerful motivator. And that's what drove me. I mean, I didn't want to fail completely. You can have intermediate failures and ultimately succeed. And that's what, and my definition of ultimate success back in the 70s was to graduate from the academy, right? So I could fail here or fail there as long as I kept my eyes on the big prize, which was, graduating with my class from the Naval Academy. You have the little failures, you just brush them off and keep the ultimate goal in mind. I mentioned earlier I was a varsity athlete. I fenced for the Naval Academy, And I spent a lot of time trying to get better at it because I'd never fenced before I went there. And so that enabled me to vent a lot of my frustrations from the academic side and the fencing. Now, you could ask, well, why didn't I just quit fencing, focus on academics? I could have done that, I suppose, but I wanted to help my teammates out, and I wanted to fence at the intercollegiate level. And so, you know, I was, you know, we're all making choices, and I was making choices along the way. You know, how can I manage my academic side and amass enough credits to graduate in a real, you know, degree? And can I keep fencing? And can I, you know, march off all the demands I had? And can I hone my craft to figure out what I want to do when I graduate? All those things, which suck up all the time in the day, but it's no different now than. It's no different then than I believe it is now. You know, it's one of the things that academies teach young men and women is time management. And I was really crappy at time management for the longest time. But all those experiences helped me when I graduated to learn how to manage my time and to keep my focus where my focus needed to be. And I'll just close this question off with a comment that as much as I struggle academically at the Naval Academy, once I graduated, all the gauges were reset to zero. So everything started over again from the day I was commissioned as an ensign in the Navy. All my academic struggles, all my academic records, all that stuff was left behind. So I started over afresh, the same place and time as my other classmates. And that's a good thing to keep in mind. If you find yourself struggling, in my opinion, if you find yourself struggling, you're at West Point.
Yes, sir. And that all that leads to our final question, and that is, knowing what you know now, what advice would you offer your younger self?
Not to sign up for Marine Engineering as a first major, and then math, physics as second and third majors. There's very few things I would do over again. That majors thing at the Naval Academy was one of those. But I believe that I picked the right branch, you know, aviation. I picked the right platform, P3s. I kept my focus on operations, and it worked out well for me. And so we know our own crews better than we know anyone else's, and we think that our path is the best path. I'm not naive to try to pass that on to anyone else, especially West Point cadets that are going to go into the Army. But I would say that to focus on the job that you're doing, and to look ahead to the next job and maybe dream about the follow-on job, but never look beyond that. You know, I've had classmates, when they were at the academy, they were talking about becoming an admiral. You know, all I wanted to do was graduate, right? That was my goal. And when I was in aviation, folks were talking about, you know, they were going to command an aircraft carrier or something 25 years down the road. I tried to focus on the job I was in, but we had to fill out this thing called a preference card, you know, tell the personnel people where you want to go next. So I thought about that. And then I dreamed about the follow-on job. But that was just a fantasy for me. You know, the focus was the job I was in, do the best I could do at that, to make the outfit, the unit, the squadron, the division, whatever it is you're in, the best. And then think about, you know, laying the groundwork for the next job, whether it's to be an instructor somewhere, whether it's to go be a White House fellow, which I was never, whether it's to go to be an admiral's aide somewhere, or to be on some staff. But you have to think about the next job. But, you know, if you think beyond that, man, you're really fantasizing. So that was my approach. And again, my approach worked for me. So I think that's the best approach. But, you know, you're going to have mentors and people who influence you. Pay attention to them. Pay attention to your mentors and seniors who are going to take the time to take you under their wing and advise you.
Yes, sir. Well, I appreciate this chance of mentorship, and also for all of our viewers and the mentorship that you also subsequently provide them as well. But Admiral Harris, thank you for your time today and for an excellent discussion about strategic leadership, team building, and the security challenges of the Indo-Pacific. On behalf of Colonel Pat Sullivan, the director of the Modern War Institute, and Dr. Charlie Faint, the director of this podcast series, it is my pleasure to present you with this rare and coveted MWI coin. Thank you, sir. And I do have to say, be Navy.
Thank you very much.
This has been an episode of 5 Questions for a General, a production of the Modern War Institute of West Point. If you like what you heard today, please download, like, subscribe, and share this podcast to help us reach an even larger audience. All statements in this podcast represent the personal views of the speakers and do not represent an official position of the United States Military Academy or the United States government.